Chapter 4. The next morning, Jack Aubrey came up from a conference, a purser's conference with Mr. Adams. Jack, like Cook and many a far-ranging captain before him, was nominally his own purser, just as Adams was nominally the captain's clerk. But by dividing the work between them, they accomplished both it and their own specific duties quite well, particularly as the anomalous status of the Surprise meant that her accounts would never have to pass the slow, circumspect eyes of the Victualling Office, for whom all persons in charge of His Majesty's stores were guilty of embezzlement until, with countersigned dockets of every conceivable nature, they could prove their innocence. At this conference they had weighed a number of sacks of dried peas, and Jack, taking advantage of the steelyard hanging from a convenient beam, had also weighed himself. To his shame he found that he had put on half a stone, and he meant to walk it off as soon as possible. He wished to hear no more flings about obesity, no more facetious remarks about letting out his waistcoats, no grave professional warnings about the price big, heavy men of a sanguine temperament had so often to pay for taking too little exercise, too much food, and too much drink. Apoplexy, softening of the brain, impotence. Fore and aft, fore and aft. Pacing the windward side of the quarter-deck, his own private realm, a narrow, unencumbered path on which he had travelled hundreds, even thousands of miles since he first commanded the Surprise, an utterly familiar terrain on which his mind could let itself run free. The breeze was too far before the beam for the ships, steering southeast, to set stunsails, but they were wearing everything they possessed, including that uncommon object, a middle staysail, and they were making 4 knots. They were an elegant sight indeed, from any distance, but from close to, a seaman's eye could still see many signs of the battering they had been through. Some knots had yet to be replaced by splices or new cordage. The fine finish of the decks had not yet been restored. In some places, what ordinarily resembled a ballroom floor still looked more like a bloody shambles, and clouds of hot volcanic ash and scoriae had played Old Harry with the paintwork and the blacking of the yards, to say nothing of the tar. An immense amount of small, unspectacular, highly skilled work was going on from one end of the ship to the other, and Captain Aubrey's walk was accompanied by the steady thump of caulkers' mallets. It was early in the day, and although the weather was as fair as could be wished, apart from the lack of wind, the quarter-deck had nobody upon it who was not called there by duty. Veedle and Reed, officer and midshipman of the watch, the men at the helm, the carpenter and two of his crew at the taffrail, putting the frigate's modest decorative carving, her gingerbread work, to rights. The usual daily procession of Jemmy Ducks, Sarah and Emily, carrying hen coops and leading the goat, Amalthea, had come and gone. And as usual, Jack, reflecting upon the rapid growth of the little girls, thought of his own daughters, their present height, weight and happiness, their possible but unlikely progress in deportment, French and the piano forte under Miss O'Mara. But neither Stephen nor Martin had appeared, nor any of the ransomers. A mile and a half of steady pacing followed these reflections about home, and then 2 distinct thoughts arose.
"I must ask Wilkins whether he will act as third lieutenant until we reach Callao. They say he was a master's mate in Agamemnon."
This second thought ran on into a consideration of those young men who, having passed the Navy's examination for a lieutenant, remained senior midshipmen or master's mates because they did not also pass for a gentleman. A mute, unwritten, unacknowledged examination, whose result was announced only by the absence of a commission. A practice that was becoming more and more frequent. He considered the advantages often put forward. A more homogeneous mess, less friction, the hands greater respect for gentlemen than for their own kind. And the disadvantages. The exclusion of such men as Cook, the unstated qualifications and the varying standards of those who did the choosing, the impossibility of appeal. He was still considering when, on reaching the rail and turning, he noticed that the young man in question, one of the ransomer mates, was now present, together with some others of those who were allowed to walk the quarter-deck. 4 turns later, he heard Reed's shrill cry of,
"Oh, no, sir, no, you cannot talk to the captain!"
And he saw Dutor heading off, admonished, led firmly back to the group to leeward.
"But what did I do?"
he cried, addressing Stephen, who'd just come up the companion ladder. "I only wish to congratulate him on his playing."
"My dear sir, you must not address the captain," said Stephen.
"You cannot possibly go over to the windward side without you are invited," said Wilkins. "Even I may not speak to him, except on duty," said Reed.
"Well," said Dutal, recovering from his surprise and concealing a certain vexation moderately well, "you are a remarkably formal, hierarchical society, I see. But I hope, sir," to Maturin, "that I may without sin tell you how much I enjoyed your music. I thought the Boccherini Adagio masterly, masterly."
They walked off, still speaking of the Boccherini, with real knowledge and appreciation on Dutor's part. Stephen, who in any case was not of an expansive nature, tended to avoid the Frenchman on general principles. But now he would voluntarily have remained in his company had not six bells struck. The sixth was followed by pandemonium fore and aft, as the launch, towing astern, was hauled alongside to receive Mr. Reed, her crew, barrels of water for the parched Franklin, and two carronades. The precious water, mercifully, could be pumped from the hold into barrels in the boat, but in the nature of things, carronades could not. They were lowered down from the reinforced main yardarm, lowered with an infinity of precautions, as though each were made of spun glass rather than of metal, and they were received with even more. They were ugly, squat little objects, yet they had their advantages, being only a third the weight of the Surprise's regular 12-pounder cannon, but firing a ball twice as heavy. Furthermore, they could be fought by a much smaller crew, two zealous hands at a pinch, as opposed to the 7 or 8 gathered round a long 12. On the other hand, they could not fire their heavy ball very far, nor very accurately. So Jack, who loved the fine work of gunnery, disabling an opponent from a distance before bearing down and boarding him, carried them chiefly as ballast, bringing them up only when he contemplated a cutting-out expedition, dashing into a harbour and blazing away at nearby batteries and the like while the boats set about their prey. Or on an occasion such as this, when the disarmed Franklin could be equipped with a 240-pound broadside.
"If this weather continues," said Jack, "and the glass is perfectly steady, the Franklin should soon be a very useful consort. And we are, after all, getting somewhat nearer the path of merchantmen, to say nothing of roving whalers."
"I wish it may go on," said Stephen. "The temperature in Paradise must have been very like this."
It did go on, day after golden day. And during the afternoons, Martin and Dutor could often be heard playing, sometimes evidently practising, since they would take a passage over and over again. Yet in spite of his music, and in spite of the fact that he played better with the Frenchman far forward than he did in the cabin, Martin was not happy. Stephen was rarely in the gunroom. Apart from anything else, Dutol, a frequent guest, was an inquisitive man, apt to ask questions, by no means always discreet. And evading inquiries was often potentially worse than answering them. And apart from the general taking of air on the quarterdeck, Stephen and his assistant met for the most part either in the sick berth or in Stephen's cabin, where their registers were kept. Both were much concerned with the effects of their treatment. They had kept accurate records over a long period, and at present it was the study and comparison of these case histories that made up the great part of their professional duty. At one of these meetings, Stephen said,
"Once again, we have not exceeded 5 knots at any time in the day, in spite of all this whistling and scratching of backstays, and it makes a great while since fresh water has been allowed for washing anything but the invalid's clothes, in spite of our prayers for rain. Yet, providing we do not die of thirst, I comfort myself with the thought that even this languid pace brings us nearly 100 miles closer to my coca leaves. 100 miles closer to wallowing in some clear, tepid stream, washing the ingrained salt from my person, and chewing coca leaves as I do so. Joy!"
Martin tapped a sheaf of papers together, and after a moment he said, "I have no notion of these palliatives, which so soon become habitual. Look what happened to poor Padine, and the way we are obliged to keep the laudanum under lock and key. Look at the spirit room in this ship, the only holy of holies necessarily guarded day and night. In one of my parishes there are no less than 7 alehouses, and some of them sell uncustomed spirits.
I hope to put all, or at least some of them, down. Dram drinking is the curse of the nation. Sometimes I turn a sermon in my mind, urging my hearers to bear their trials, to rely on their own fortitude, on fortitude from within, rather than their muddy ale, tobacco, or dram drinking. If a man has put his hand into boiling water, is he not to pull it out? Certainly he is to pull it out. A momentary action. What I deprecate is the persistent indulgence.
Stephen looked at Martin curiously. This was the first time his assistant had spoken to him in a disobliging, if not downright uncivil, manner, and some brisk repartees came into his mind. He said nothing, however, but sat wondering what frustrations, jealousies, discontents had been at work on Nathaniel Martin to produce this change not only of tone, but even of voice itself, and conceivably of identity. The words and the manner of uttering them were completely out of character. When the silence had lasted some heavy moments, Martin said,
"I hope you do not think there is anything personal about my remarks. It was only that your mention of coca leaves set my mind running in another direction."
The shattering din of the Franklin as she fired first her starboard and then her larboard broadside, and as her captain desired his men to
look alive and bear a hand,
interrupted him. There were only these two to test the slides and tackle, but they were rippling broadsides, and they lasted long enough to drown Martin's last words, and the first of those spoken by the newly arrived Norton, although he roared them. He was therefore obliged to repeat, still as though he were hailing the masthead,
"Captain's compliments to Mr. Martin, and will be glad of his company at dinner tomorrow."
"My duty and best compliments to the captain, and shall be happy to wait on him," said Martin. "And Franklin has hailed to say that Captain Pullings has put his jaw out again."
This to Dr. Maturin.
"I shall be over in a moment," said Stephen. "Pray, Mr. Norton, get them to lower down my little skiff. Padine," he called in Irish to his huge loblolly boy, "leap into the little boat, will you now, and row me over?"
"Shall I bring bandages and perhaps the Batavia salve?" asked Martin.
"Never in life. Do not stir. I have known this wound since it was made."
That was many years since, in the Ionian Sea, when a Turk gave Pullings a terrible slash on the side of his face with a scimitar, so damaging his cheekbone and the articulation of the joint that it often slipped, particularly when Captain Pullings was calling out with more than usual force. Stephen had put it more or less right at the time, and now he did so again, but it was a delicate little operation, and one that required a hand with a knowledge of the wound. This was the first time Stephen had been aboard the Franklin for any length of time since the earlier critical days, when his horizon was almost entirely bounded by the walls of his operating and dressing stations. Blood and bones, splints, lint, tow and bandages, sores, retractors, artery hooks, and he had had little time to see her as a ship, to see her from within. Nor, of course, had Tom Pullings been able to show the doctor his new command, already very near to his heart.
"I am so glad you was not obliged to come across before we had our whole armament aboard," he said.
"Now you will see how trim and neat they sit in their ports, and how well they can traverse, particularly those amidships. And I will show you our new cross catarpins, rigged this very afternoon. They bring in the foremast and aftermast shrouds, as I dare say you noticed when Padine was pulling you over. And there are a vast number of other things that will astonish you."
A vast number indeed. A vaster number of objects than Dr. Maturin had supposed to exist in any ship afloat. Long, long ago, at the beginning of Stephen's naval career, Pullings, then a long, thin midshipman, had shown him over His Majesty's ship Sophie, a brig, Jack Aubrey's first, dwarfish command. He had done so kindly, conscientiously, but as a subordinate displaying her main features to a landsman. Now it was a captain showing his new ship to a man with many years of sea experience, and Stephen was spared nothing at all. A fancy line rigged on new principles, these cross catarpins, of course, drawings of an improved dumb chalder to be shipped when she docked at Callao. Yet although this guide was now burlier by far, and almost unrecognisable from his frightful wound, there was the same ingenuous open friendliness, an unchanged pleasure in life, in sea-going life, and Stephen followed him about, admiring and exclaiming, "Dear me, how very fine!" until the sun set, and the twilight, sweeping over the sky with tropical rapidity, soon left even Pullings without anything to point at.
"Thank you for showing me your ship," said Stephen, going over the side. "For her size, she is the beauty of the world."
"Not at all," said Tom, simpering, "but I am afraid I was too long-winded."
"Never in life, my dear. God bless now. Padim, shove away, give off."
"Good night, sir,"
said the seven Sethians, their smiles gleaming in the massive beards as they thrust the skiff clear with a boom.
"Good night, Doctor," called Pullings. "I forgot the plan of the new Fairleads, but I promise to show it to you tomorrow. The captain has invited me to dinner."
"I am glad of that," thought Stephen, waving his hat. "It will make the party less awkward."
He did not see Martin again that evening, but he thought of him from time to time. And when he had turned in, when he was lying in his cot, very gently rocking on the quiet sea, he reflected not so much upon the outburst of that afternoon as upon the notion of changed identity. He had known it often enough. A delightful child, even a delightful early adolescent, interested in everything, alive, affectionate, would turn into a thick, heavy, stupid brute and never recover. Aging men would become wholly self-centred, indifferent to those who had been their friends, avaricious. Yet apart from the very strong, very ugly passions arising from inheritance or political disagreement, he had not known it in men neither young nor old. He swung and thought, his mind wandering free, sometimes to the allied but quite distinct subject of inconstancy in love. And presently he found that this too was to be a sleepless night. The moon was high when he came on deck, and there was a heavy dew.
"Why, then," he asked, feeling the rail wet under his hand, "with so heavy a dew, is the moon not veiled, nor yet the stars?"
"Have you come on deck, sir?"
asked Fiedel, who had the middle watch.
"I have too," said Maturin, "and should be obliged if you would tell me about the dew. One says it falls, but does it fall, in fact? And if it fall, where does it fall from? And why, in falling, does it not obscure the moon?"
"Little do I know of the dew, sir," said Veedle. "All I can say is that it loves a clear night and air as near still as can be. And every sailor knows it tightens all cordage right wicked, so you must slacken all over if you do not want your masts rung. It is a very heavy dew tonight, to be sure," he went on, having reflected, "and we have clapped garlands on the masts to collect it as it trickles down. If you listen, you can hear it running into the butts. It don't amount to much, and it don't taste very good, the masts having been paid with slush, but I have known many a voyage when it was uncommon welcome. And in any case, it is fresh, and will wash a shirt clear of salt, or even better," lowering his voice, "a pair of drawers. The salt is devilish severe on the parts. Which reminds me, sir, I must beg some more of your ointment."
"By all means. Look in at the sick berth when I make my morning rounds, and Padine will whip you up a gallipot directly."
Silence. A vast, moonlit space, but no horizon. Stephen gazed up at the dew-soaked sails, dark in the moon shadow, the t'gallants and topsails rounding just enough to send the ship whispering along, the courses hanging slack.
"As for the dew," said Veedle, after a while, "you might ask Mr. Dutord. There's a learned gentleman for you. Not in physic, of course, but more in the philosophical and moral line. Though, as I understand it, he has many friends in Paris who make experiments with the electric fluid, gas balloons, the weight of air, that kind of thing, and perhaps dew might have come into it. But what a pleasure it is to hear him talk about moral politics, the rights of man, brotherhood, you know, and equality. He has edified us many an hour with his observations, you might almost say his oratory, on the just republic. And the colony he planned, no privileges, no oppression, no money, no greed, everything held in common, like in a mess with good shipmates. No statutes, no lawyers. The voice of the people, the only law, the only court of justice. Everybody to worship the supreme being just as he sees fit. No interference, no compulsion, complete freedom."
"It sounds like the earthly paradise."
"That is what many of our people say. And some declare they would not have been so eager to stop Mr. Dutord if they had known what he was about. Might even have joined him."
Do they not reflect that he was preying on our whalers and merchantmen, and helping Kalahua in his war with Pualani?
Oh, as for the privateering side, that was entirely his Yankee sailing master, and they would certainly never have joined in that, not against their own countrymen, though natural enough, in wartime, on the part of a foreigner. No, it was the colony that pleased them so, with its peace and equality and a decent life, without working yourself to the bone and an old age that don't bear thinking on.
Peace and equality, with all my heart, said Stephen.
But you shake your head, sir, and I dare say you are thinking about that war. It was sadly misrepresented, but Mr. Dutour has made everything quite clear. The sides have been spoiling for a fight, time out of mind, and once Kalahua had hired those riff-raff Frenchmen from the Sandwich Islands with muskets, there was no holding him. They had nothing to do with Mr. Dutour's settlers. No, what Mr. D meant to do was to sail in with a show of force and set himself between them, then establish his own colony and win both sides over by example and persuasion. And as for persuasion, if you had heard him, you would have been convinced directly. He has a wonderful gift, you might say an unction, even in a foreign language. Our people think the world of him.
He certainly speaks English remarkably well.
And not only that, sir, he is remarkably good to what were his own men. You know how he sat up with them night after night in the sick berth until they were either cured or put over the side. And although the master of the Franklin and his mates were right hard horse drivers, the men who are with us now say Mr. D was always stepping in to protect them, would not have them flogged.
At this point, just before 8 bells, a sleepy, yawning Granger came on deck to relieve his shipmate, and the starboard watch, most of whom had been sleeping in the waist, began to stir. The ship came to a muted sort of life.
3 knots, sir, if you please, reported young Weddle, now an acting midshipman.
And in the usual piping, calling, hurrying sounds of the change, all fairly discreet at 4 o'clock in the morning, Stephen slipped away to his cabin. There was something curiously pleasing about the Nipper Dolling's credulity, he reflected as he lay there with his hands behind his head, an amiable simplicity. And he was still smiling when he went to sleep. To sleep. But not for long. Presently the idlers were called, and they joined the watch in the daily ritual of cleaning the decks, pumping floods of seawater over them, sanding, holy stoning and swabbing them, flogging them dry by the rising of the sun. There were hardened sailors who could sleep through all this. Jack Aubrey was one, and he could be heard snoring yet, but Stephen was not. On this occasion it did not make him unhappy or fretful, however, and he lay there placidly thinking of a number of pleasant things. Clarissa came into his mind. She too had something of that simplicity, in spite of a life as hard as could well be imagined.
"Are you awake?"
asked Jack Aubrey in a hoarse whisper through a crack in the door.
"I am not," said Stephen, "nor do I choose to swim. But I will take coffee with you when you return to the ship." "The animal," he added to himself. "I never heard him get up."
It was true. Jack weighed far too much, but he was still remarkably light on his feet. With this fine, brisk start to the day, Dr. Maturin was early for his morning rounds, a rare thing in one with so vague a notion of time. These rounds amounted to little from the strictly surgical point of view, but Stephen still had some obstinate bleats and poxes. In long, fairly quiet passages, these and scurvy were the medical man's daily fare. But whereas Stephen could oblige the seamen to avoid scurvy by drinking lemon juice in their grog, no power on earth could prevent them from hurrying to bawdy houses as soon as they were ashore. These cases he treated with calomel and guaiacum, and it was usual for the draughts to be prepared by Martin. Stephen was not satisfied with the progress of two of his patients, and he had resolved upon dosing them in the far more radical Viennese manner when he saw a beetle on the deck just this side of the half-open door, clear in the light of the dispensary lantern. A yellow beetle. A longicorn, of course, but what longicorn? An active longicorn, in any event. He dropped onto his hands and knees and crept silently towards it. With the beetle in his handkerchief, he looked up. His advance had brought the door directly in front of him, with the whole dispensary lit, clear, and as it were in another world. There was Martin, gravely mixing the last of his row of draughts, and as Stephen watched, he raised the glass and drank it off. Stephen rose to his feet and coughed.
Martin turned sharply.
"Good morning, sir,"
he said, whipping the glass under his apron. The greeting was civil, but mechanically so, with no spontaneous smile. He had obviously not forgotten yesterday's unpleasantness, and he appeared both to resent his exclusion from the passage to the Franklin and to expect resentment on Stephen's part for his offensive remarks. Stephen was, in fact, of a saturnine temperament, as Martin knew. He could even have been called revengeful, and he found it difficult to forgive a slight. But there was more than this. It was as though Martin had just escaped being detected in an act he was very willing to conceal, and there was some remaining tinge of defiant hostility about his attitude. Padine came in, and having called on God to bless the gentleman, he announced with some difficulty that the sick berth was ready for their honours. The medical men went from cot to cot, Stephen asking each man how he did, taking his pulse and examining his peccant parts. He discussed each case briefly with his assistant, in Latin, and Martin wrote down his observations in a book. As the book closed, so Padine gave each seaman his draught and pills. When it was over, they returned to the dispensary, and while Padine was washing the glasses, Stephen said, "I'm not satisfied with Grant or Macduff, and intend to put them on the Viennese treatment next week.
My authorities speak of it, but I do not recall that they name its principle. It is the Murias Hydragi Corrosivus. The phial next to the myrrh? I have never known it used."
"Just so. I reserve it for the most obdurate cases. There are grave disadvantages. Now, Padine, what is amiss?"
Padine's stammer, always bad, grew worse with emotion, but in time it appeared that there had been 10 glasses in the cupboard an hour ago, not even an hour ago, and they shining. Now there were only 9. He held up his spread hands with one finger folded down and repeated,
"9? "I am so sorry, sir," said Martin. "I broke one when I was mixing the draughts, and I forgot to tell Padine."
Both Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin were much attached to their wives, and both wrote to them at quite frequent intervals. But whereas Jack's letters owed their whole existence to the hope that they would reach home by some means or another, merchantman, man of war, or packet, or failing that, that they would travel there in his own sea chest and be read aloud to Sophie with explanations of just how the wind lay or the current set, Stephen's were not always intended to be sent at all. Sometimes he wrote them in order to be in some kind of contact with Diana, however remote and one-sided. Sometimes to clarify things in his own mind. Sometimes for the relief and pleasure of saying things that he could say to no one else. And these, of course, had but an ephemeral life.
"My dearest soul," he wrote, "when the last element of a problem, code or puzzle falls into place, the solution is sometimes so obvious that one claps one's hand to one's forehead, crying, 'Fool, not to have seen that before!' For some considerable time now, as you would know very well if we had some power of instant communication, I have been concerned about the change in my relations with Nathaniel Martin, by the change in him and by his unhappiness. Many and sound reasons did I adduce when last I wrote, naming an undue concern with money and a conviction that its possession should, in common justice, win him more consideration and happiness than he possesses, as well as many other causes, such as jealousy, the boredom of uncongenial companions from whom there is no escape, a longing for home, wife, relations, consequence, peace and quiet, and a fundamental unsuitability for naval life, prolonged naval life. But I did not mention the efficient cause because I did not perceive it until today, though it should have been evident enough from his intense application to Astruc, Boerhaave, Lind, Hunter, and what few other authorities on the venereal distemper we possess. We lack both Locker and Van Sweeten. But even more from his curiously persistent, eager, detailed inquiries about the possibility of infection from using the same seat of ease, drinking from the same cup, kissing, toying and the like. Whether he has the disease I cannot tell for sure without a proper examination, though I doubt he has it physically. Metaphysically, however, he is in a very bad way. Whether he lay with her or not, in fact, he certainly wished to do so, and he is clerk enough to know that the wish is the sin, and being also persuaded that he is diseased, he looks upon himself with horror, unclean without and within. Unhappily, he has taken yesterday's disagreement more seriously than I did. Our relations are a cool civility at the best, and in these circumstances he will not consult me. Nor, obviously, can I obtrude my services. Self-hatred usually seems more likely to generate hatred of others, or at least surliness and a sense of grievance, than mansuetude. Poor fellow, he is invited to dine in the cabin this afternoon and to bring his viola. I dread some kind of éclat. He is in a very nervous state. There was a confident knock on the door, and Mr. Reed walked smiling in, quite sure of his welcome. From time to time, what was left of his arm needed dressing, and this was one of the appointed days. Stephen had forgotten it. Padine had not, and the bandage stood on the aftermost locker. While it was putting on, fold after exactly spaced fold, Reed said, "Oh, sir, I had a wonderful thought in the graveyard watch. Please would you do me a great kindness?" "I might," said Stephen. "I was thinking about going to Somerset House to pass for Lieutenant when we get home." "But you are not nearly old enough, my dear." "No, sir, but you can always add a year or two. The examining captain's only put appears to be 19 years of age, you know. Besides, I shall be 19 in time, of course, particularly if we go on at this pace, and I have my proper certificates of sea time served. Now, the thing that worried me was that since I am now only a tripod rather than a quadruped, they might be doubtful about passing me. So I have to have everything on my side. These calm days I've been copying out my journals fair, you have to show them up, you know, and in the night it suddenly occurred to me that it would be a brilliant stroke and amaze the captains was I to add some seaman-like details in French. Sure, it could not fail to do so. So I thought if I took Colin, one of the Franklins in my division, a decent fellow and prime seaman, though he has scarcely a word of English, onto the forecastle in the first dog, shall we say, sir, and pointed to everything belonging to the foremast, and he told me the French, and you told me how to write it down, that would be very capital. It would knock the captains flat. Such zeal! But I'm afraid I'm asking for too much of your time, sir." "Not at all. Hold this end of the bandage, will you now? There. Belay and heave off handsomely." "Thank you very much indeed, sir. I am infinitely obliged. Until the first dog, then."
"Never you think so, Mr. Reed, sir," said Killick,
coming in with Stephen's new-brushed good blue coat and white kerseymere breeches over his arm.
"Not the first dog, no, nor yet the last, which the doctor is going to dine with the captain, and I won't be done in the melodious line before the setting of the watch. Now, sir, if you please," to Stephen, "let me have that wicked old shirt and put this one on, straight from the smoothing iron. There is not a moment to be lost."
In fact, the dinner went off remarkably well. Martin might not carry Jack Aubrey in his heart, but he respected him as a naval commander and as a patron. It would be ungenerous to say that his respect was increased by the prospect of another benefice to come, but at some level the fact may well have had its influence. At all events, in spite of looking drawn and unwell, he played his part as a cheerful, appreciative guest quite well, except that he drank almost no wine, and he told two anecdotes of his own initiative, one of a trout that he tickled as a boy under the fall of a weir, and one of an aunt who had a cat, a valuable cat, that lived with her in a house near the Pool of London. The animal vanished, inquiries in every direction, tears that lasted a year. Indeed, until the day the cat walked in, leapt onto its accustomed chair by the fire, and began to wash. Curiosity had led it aboard a ship bound for Suriname, a ship from the Pool that had just returned. After dinner, it was proposed that they should play, and since one of the chief purposes of the feast was to give Tom Pullings pleasure, they played tunes he knew very well. Songs as often as not, and dances, some delightful melodies with variations on them, and from time to time Jack and Pullings sang.
"Your viola has profited immensely from its repair," said Jack when they were standing up for leave-taking. "It has a charming tone."
"Thank you, sir," said Martin. "Mr. Dutour has improved my fingering, tuning, and bowing. He knows a great deal about music. He loves to play."
"Ah, indeed," said Jack. "Now, Tom, do not forget your horizon glass, I beg."
In his role of virtually omnipotent captain, Jack could be deaf to a hint, particularly if it reached him indirectly.
Stephen was less well-placed, and 2 days later, when Dutton, having wished him a good morning and having spoken of the pleasure it had given him to linger on the quarter-deck all the time they played, went on to say, with an ease that surprised Maturin, until he recalled that wealthy men were used to having their wishes regarded,
"It would perhaps be too presumptuous of me to entreat you to let Captain Aubrey know that it would give me even greater pleasure to be admitted to one of your sessions. I am no virtuoso, but I have held my own in quite distinguished company, and if I were allowed to play second fiddle, we might embark upon quartets, which have always seemed to me the quintessence of music."
"I will mention it if you wish," said Stephen, "but I should observe that in general the captain looks upon these as little private affairs, quite unbuttoned and informal."
"Then perhaps I must be content to listen from afar," said Dutton, taking no apparent offence. "Yet it would be benevolent in you to speak of it, if a suitable occasion should offer."
He broke off to ask what was going on aboard the Franklin. Stephen told him that they were rigging out the fatigallant stunsail booms.
"Le bout dehors des bonnettes du petit perroquet," he added, seeing Dutton's look of blank ignorance,
an ignorance equal to his own, until yesterday, when he had helped Reed to write the terms in his journal. From this they moved on to a consideration of sails in general, and after a while, when Stephen was already impatient to be gone, Dutton, looking him full in the face, said,
"It is surely very remarkable that you should know the French for stunsail booms as well as for so many animals and birds. But it is true that you have a remarkable command of our language."
A meditative pause.
"And now that I have the honour of being better acquainted with you, it seems to me that we may have met before. Do not you know Georges Cuvier?"
"I have been introduced to Monsieur Cuvier."
"Yes. And were you not at Madame Roland's soirees from time to time?"
"You are probably thinking of my cousin Domanova. We are often confused."
"Perhaps so. But tell me, sir, how do you come to have a cousin called Domanova?"
Stephen looked at him with astonishment, and Dutton, visibly drawing himself in, said,
"Forgive me, sir. I am impertinent."
"Not at all, sir," replied Stephen, walking off.
His inward voice ran on.
"Is it possible that the animal has recognized me, that he has some notion, however vague, of what we are about, and that this is in some degree a threat?"
Dutton's was not an easy face to read. Superficially it had the open simplicity of an enthusiast, together with the politeness of his class and nation. These did not, of course, exclude everyday cunning and duplicity, but there was also something else, a slight insistence in his look, a certain self-confidence that might mean far deeper implications.
"Shall I never learn to keep my mouth shut?" he muttered, opening the sick berth door, and aloud, "God and Mary and Patrick be with you," in answer to Padine's greeting. "Mr. Martin, a good morning to you." How these halcyon days go on and on, the one following the other with only a perfect night between, he said, walking into the cabin. We might almost be on dry land. But tell me, Jack, will it never rain at all? Hush, I interrupt your calculations, I find.
What is 12 sixes?
Asked Jack. 92, said Stephen. My shirt is like a silus with the salt. I should wear it dirty and reasonably soft, but that killick takes it away. He finds it out with a devilish ingenuity and flings it into the sea-water tub, and I'm convinced that he adds more salt from the brine tubs.
What is a silus?
It is a penitential garment made of the harshest cloth known to man, and worn next to the skin by saints, hermits, and the more anxious sinners.
Jack returned to his figures, and Stephen to his disagreeable reflections.
What goeth before destruction? He asked. Pride goeth before destruction, that is what. I was so proud of knowing those spars in English, let alone in French, that I could not contain, but must be blabbing like a fool. Hair shirt, indeed. The dear knows I deserve one.
In time Jack put down his pen and said,
As for rain, there is no hope of it according to the glass. But I have been casting the prize accounts, as far as I can, without figures for the Franklin's specie. A roundish figure, which is some sort of consolation.
Very good. To predatory creatures like myself there is something wonderfully fetching about a prize. The very word evokes a smile of concupiscent greed. Speaking of the Franklin reminds me that Dutoc wishes you to know that he would be glad of an invitation to play music with us.
So I gather from Martin, said Jack, and I thought it a most uncommon stroke of effrontery. A fellow with wild, bloody, regicide revolutionary ideas like Tom Paine and Charles Fox, and all those wicked fellows at Brooks's, and that adulterous cove, I forget his name, but you know who I mean.
I do not believe I am acquainted with any adulterers, Jack.
Well, never mind. A fellow who roams about the sea, attacking our merchantmen with no commission or letter of marque from anyone, next door to a pirate if not actually bound for execution dock. Be damned if I should invite him if he were a second Tartini, which he ain't. And in any case, I disliked him from the start, disliked everything I heard of him. Enthusiasm, democracy, universal benevolence, a pretty state of affairs.
He has qualities.
Oh, yes, he is not shy, and he stood up very well for his own people.
Some of ours think highly of him and his ideas.
I know they do. We have some hands from Shelmiston, decent men and prime seamen who are little better than Democrats, Republicans, if you follow me, and would easily be led astray by a clever political cove with a fine flow of words. But the man-of-war's men, particularly the old surprises, do not like him. They call him Monsieur Turd, and they will not be won round by smirking and leering and the brotherhood of man. They dislike his notions as much as I do.
They are tolerably chimerical, admittedly, and it is surprising that a man of his age and his parts should still entertain them. In 1789 I too had great hopes of my fellows, but now I believe the only point on which Dutoc and I are in agreement is slavery.
Well, as for slavery, it is true that I should not like to be one myself, yet Nelson was in favour of it, and he said that the country's shipping would be ruined if the trade were put down. Perhaps it comes more natural if you are black. But come, I remember how you tore that unfortunate scrub Bosville to pieces years ago in Barbados for saying that the slaves liked it, that it was in their master's interest to treat them kindly, that doing away with slavery would be shutting the gates of mercy on the Negroes. Hey, hey, the strongest language I have ever heard you use. I wonder he did not ask for satisfaction.
I think I feel more strongly about slavery than anything else, even that vile Bonaparte, who is in any case one aspect of it. Bosville, the sanctimonious hypocrite, the silly blackguard with his gates of mercy, his soul to the devil. A mercy that includes chains and whips and branding with a hot iron. Satisfaction. I should have given it him with the utmost goodwill. 2 ounces of lead or a span of sharp steel, though common ratsbane would have been more appropriate.
Why, Stephen, you're in quite a passion.
So I am. It is a retrospective passion, sure, but I feel it still. Thinking of that ill-looking, flabby, ornamented, conceited, self-complacent, ignorant, shallow, mean-spirited, cowardly young shite with absolute power over 1,500 blacks makes me fairly tremble even now. It moves me to grossness. I should have kicked him if ladies had not been present.
Come in, called Jack.
Mr. Grainger's duty, sir, said Norton, and the wind is hauling aft. May I set the weather stunsails?
Certainly, Mr. Norton, as soon as they will stand. I shall come on deck the moment I have finished these accounts. If the French gentleman is at hand, pray tell him I should like to see him in 10 minutes. Compliments, of course.
Aye, aye, sir. Stunsails as soon as they will stand. Captain's compliments to Monsieur Turd.
Dutoul, Mr. Norton.
Beg pardon, sir, to Monsieur Dutoul, and wishes to see him in 10 minutes.
On receiving this message, Dutoul thanked the midshipman, looked at Martin with a smile, and began walking up and down from the taffrail to the leeward bow chaser, and back again, looking at his watch at each turn.
"Come in,"
cried Jack Aubrey yet again.
"Come in, monsieur, Mr. Dutoul, and sit down. I am casting my prize money accounts, and should be obliged for a statement of the amount of specie, bills of exchange, and the like carried in the Franklin. I must also know, of course, where it is kept."
Dutoul's expression changed to an extraordinary degree, not merely from confident, pleasurable anticipation to its opposite, but from lively intelligence to a pale stupidity. Jack went on.
"The money taken from your prizes will be returned to its former owners. I already have sworn statements from the ransomers, and the Franklin's remaining treasure will be shared out among her captors according to the laws of the sea. Your private purse, like your private property, will be left to you, but its amount is to be written down."
Dutoul's wits had returned to him by now. Jack Aubrey's massive confidence told him that any sort of protest would be worse than useless.
Indeed, this treatment compared most favourably with the Franklins, whose prisoners were stripped bare, but the long pause between capture and destitution, so very unlike the instant looting he had seen before, had bred illogical hopes. He managed a look of unconcern, however, and said,
"Ve victis,"
and produced two keys from an inner pocket.
"I hope you may not find that my former shipmates have been there before you," he added. "There were some grasping fellows among them."
There were some grasping fellows aboard the Surprise, too. If men who dearly love to get their hands upon immediate, ringing gold and silver, rather than amiable but mute, remote, almost theoretical pieces of paper, are to be called grasping. There had been the sound of chuckling throughout the ship ever since Oracle Killick let it be known
that the skipper had got round to it at last,
and a boat carrying Mr. Reed, Mr. Adams, and Mr. Dutor's servant had pulled across to the Franklin, returning with a heavy chest that came aboard not indeed to cheers, for that would not have been manners, but with great cheerfulness, goodwill, and anxious care while it hung in the void, and witticisms as it swung inboard, to be lowered as handsomely as a thousand of eggs. Even until the next day, however, Stephen Maturin remained unaware of all this, for not only had he dined by himself in the cabin, Jack Aubrey being aboard the Franklin, but his mind was almost entirely taken up with cephalopods. And as far as he took notice of the gaiety at all, by no means uncommon in the Surprise, that happy ship, he attributed it to the freshening of the breeze, which was now sending the two ships along at close on 5 knots, with promise of better to come. He had had to make his morning rounds alone, Martin having remained in bed with what he described as a sick headache. Jack's breakfast and Stephen's had for once failed to coincide, and they had exchanged no more than a wave from the sea to the deck before Stephen sat down to his collection. Some of his cephalopods were dried, some were in spirits. One was fresh. Having ranged the preserved specimens in due order and checked the labels, and above all the spirit level, a necessary precaution at sea where he had known jars drained dry, even those containing asps and scorpions, he turned to the most interesting and most recent creature, a decapod that had fixed the terrible hooks and suckers of its long arms into the net of salt beef towing over the side to get rid of at least some of the salt before the pieces went into the steep tub, had fixed them with such obstinate strength that it had been drawn aboard. With Sarah and Emily standing in opposite corners of the cabin and holding the squid's arms just so, Stephen snipped, drew, and described, dissecting out various processes for preservation. There was, alas, no possibility of keeping the entire animal, even if he had possessed a jar large enough, since it was Mr. Veedle's property, he having detached it from the beef at the cost of some cruel wounds, a spiteful decapod, and having promised it to the gunroom cook for today's feast, this Friday being the day when, on the other side of the world, Shelmerston, forgetting all differences of creed, lit bonfires and danced round them singing a chant whose meaning was now lost, but which as late as Leland's time was clearly in honour of the goddess Frigg. And even today the words retained such power that, as Stephen well knew, no Shelmerstonian born and bred would willingly omit them. The little girls were usually as good and silent as could be on these occasions, but now the coming of the feast and the arrival of the prize money overcame Sarah's discretion, and she said,
"Jemmy Duck says Monsieur Turd's nose is sadly out of joint. He kicked Jean Potin's arse. Jean Potin is his servant."
"Hush, my dear," said Stephen. "I am counting the suckers. And you are not to say Monsieur Turd, nor arse."
Emily prized Stephen's attention and approval more than her immortal soul. Though an affectionate child, she would betray her best friend to obtain it. And now she called out from her corner,
"She's always saying Monsieur Turd. Mr. Granger checked her for saying it only yesterday. He declared it was wicked to speak so of such a benevolent gentleman."
"Heave that tentacle taut," said Stephen. "Never mind your pinafores."
He knew the squid's destination, and he was working fast with great concentration. Yet well before the description was complete, there was a gunroom cook's mate begging his pardon, but so horny an old bugger, if his honour would excuse the word, needed a good hour in the pot. His honour sighed quickly, removed one last ganglion, and sat back.
"Thank you, my dears," he said to the little girls. "Give Nicholson a hand with the longer arms. And Sarah, before you go, pass me the frigate bird, will you now?"
He was pretty well acquainted with frigate birds, as any man who had sailed so far in tropical waters must be, and he had skinned quite a number, distinguishing three or perhaps four closely allied species and making careful descriptions of their plumage. But he had never thoroughly dissected one. This he now settled himself to do, meaning first to examine the flight muscles, for in their lofty soaring the frigate birds were perhaps even more remarkable than the albatrosses, and he had scarcely laid bare the breast before he had a premonition that he might be on the verge of the finest anatomical study of his career. The bird, naturally enough, possessed a wishbone. Yet from the very first it had seemed extraordinarily, unnaturally firm under his touch. As his scalpel worked delicately down towards the keel of the breastbone, a spatula easing the muscles aside, he was perfectly deaf to the ring of coins and the powerful voices on the other side of the bulkhead. Captain Aubrey, the two oldest forecastle hands, rather hard of hearing, and Mr. Adams telling over the treasure of the Franklin, converting it into Spanish dollars and reckoning the shares, and to those on the quarterdeck. An extraordinary number of hands had found tasks that kept them within earshot of the open companion, and they kept up a murmured commentary upon the amounts, provenance, and rates of exchange of the coins handled below, showing a wonderful grasp of the European and American system, switching from Dutch Rijksdollars to Hanover ducats, with as much ease as from Barcelona pistoles to Portuguese joes, Venice sequins, or Jamaica guineas. The murmur, the remarkably strong murmur, ceased when hands were piped to dinner, but the telling in the great cabin continued, while Stephen, without a thought for anything else, steadily exposed the upper thorax of the frigate bird. He had not quite bared all the essentials by the time Killick and Padine came in, fairly skipping with impatience, to say that the gunroom was assembling, the feast was almost underway. He submitted to their attentions and hurried below, properly dressed, fairly clean, with his wig straight on his head and a look of shining delight still on his face.
"Why, gentlemen," he cried on entering the gunroom, "I am afraid I was almost late."
"It is no matter," said Granger. "We had another wet, and feel the better for it. But now I will ask Mr. Martin to say grace, and we will set to."
Martin had been moved to make room for two more Shelmerstonians from the prize, and now he was on Stephen's right. He was looking ill and thin, and when they sat down, Stephen said to him in a low voice, "I trust I see you tolerably well?"
"Perfectly so, I thank you," said Martin without a smile. "It was only a passing malaise."
"I am glad to hear it. But you must certainly stay on deck this evening,"
said Stephen, and after a pause, "I have just made a discovery that I think will please you. In the frigate bird, the symphysis of the furcula coalesces with the carina, and the upper end of each ramus with the caricoid, while in its turn each caricoid coalesces with the proximal end of the scapula."
His look of modest triumph faded as he saw that Martin's anatomy did not appear to reach so far, or at least not to grasp at the consequences. And he went on,
"The result, of course, is that the whole assembly is entirely rigid, apart from the slight flexion of the rami. I believe this to be unique among existing birds, and closely related to the creature's flight."
"It is of some interest, if your example was not a sport," said Martin, "and perhaps it justifies taking the bird's life away. But how often have we seen hecatombs that yield nothing of significance? Hundreds and hundreds of stomachs opened, all with much the same result. Even Mr. White of Selborne shot very great numbers. Sometimes I feel that a dissection may take place merely to warrant the killing."
Stephen had often known patients eager to be disagreeable, a common morbid irritability, especially in putrid fevers, but it was almost invariably kept for their friends and relations, rarely extending to their medical men. On the other hand, although Martin was undoubtedly sick, Stephen was not in fact his physician, nor was it likely that Martin would consult him. He made no reply, turning to Mr. Granger with praise of the squid soup. But he was wounded, deeply disappointed, far from pleased. Opposite him sat Dutour, apparently in much the same unenviable state of mind. Both men, however, kept up a creditable appearance of urbanity for some time. They even exchanged remarks about the squid, though it was clear to most of the table that not only was Dutour's nose out of joint, but that he held the doctor in some degree responsible. For Granger, Vidal, and the rest,
privateers or man-of-war's men, taking or being taken was as much part of sea-going life as fair weather or foul, and they accepted these things as they came. But they knew that this was the first time Dutour had been stripped, relatively stripped, and they treated him with a particular deferential gentleness, rather as though he were recently bereaved. This had the effect of making him more loquacious than usual. Towards pudding time his voice rose from the tone of conversation to something nearer that of public address, and Stephen realized with dismay that they were to hear a discourse on Rousseau and the proper education of children. The plum duff vanished, the cloth was drawn, the decanters moved steadily round. Dutour boomed on. Stephen had stopped listening several glasses back. His mind turned sometimes with glowing joy to his discovery, more often with intense irritation at Martin's obvious desire to wound. It was true that Martin was much more an observer of birds, an accurate, highly experienced observer, than a systematic ornithologist, basing his taxonomy upon anatomical principles, yet even so. Dr. Maturin had curiously pale eyes, which he often covered with blue spectacles. He was not wearing them at present, and this pallor was much accentuated by the mahogany tan of his face on the one hand, and on the other by the cold displeasure with which he reflected upon his assistant, now sitting by him in dogged silence. He was gazing straight before him in one of these reveries when Dutour, pouring himself yet another glass of port, caught his eye, and taking the glare as a personal reflection, he said, "But I am afraid, Doctor, that you do not share our opinion of Jean-Jacques."
"Rousseau?" said Stephen, returning to the immediate present and composing his features to a more sociable amenity, or at least adopting a less grim and even sinister expression. "Rousseau? Faith, little do I know of him, apart from the Devin du Village, which I enjoyed. But his theories have been floating about me forever, and once an admirer made me swear to read the Confessions. I did so. An oath is sacred. But all the time I was reminded of a cousin, a priest, who told me that the most tedious, squalid, and disheartening part of his duty was listening to penitents who, having made the act of contrition, recounted imaginary, fictitious sins, unclean phantasms.
And the most painful was the giving of an absolution that might be blasphemous."
"You surely did not doubt Rousseau's truthfulness?"
"Out of common charity I was obliged to do so."
"I do not understand you, sir."
"You will recall that in this book he speaks of 4 or 5 children his mistress bore him, children that were at once dismissed to the foundling hospital. Now this does not agree very well with his praise of the domestic affections, still less with his theories of education in Emile. So unless I was to think of him as a hypocrite, where bringing up the young was concerned, I was compelled to regard him as a begetter of false babies." The ransomer merchants at the end of the table, earthy creatures, who, unlike their serious hosts, had been growing more and more restless, burst into a great horse laugh at the words "false babies," and clawing one another on the back, they called out,
"Hear him! Very good! Hear him! Those children can perfectly well be explained to a candid mind," cried Dutour over the hubbub, "but where there is a fixed prejudice, an evident hatred of progress and enlightenment, a love of privilege and outworn custom, a denial of the essential goodness of man, a settled malevolence, I have nothing to say."
Stephen bowed, and turning to the troubled acting first lieutenant, he said,
"Mr. Granger, sir, you will forgive me if I leave you at this point. Yet before I go, before I sling my hook, allow me to propose a toast to Shelmiston. Bumpers, gentlemen, if you please, and no heel taps. Here's to Shelmiston, and may we soon sail in over her bar with never a scrape."
"Shelmiston, Shelmiston, Shelmiston forever!"
they cried as he walked off, returning to the great cabin and feeling the ship's much stronger pitch and roll as he went.
He found Jack well into his dinner and sat down beside him.
"Will I confess a grave sin?" he asked.
"Do, by all means," said Jack, looking at him kindly. "But if you managed to commit a grave sin between the gunroom and here, you have a wonderful capacity for evil."
Stephen took a piece of biscuit, tapping it mechanically, brushed away the weevil frass, and said,
"I was in a wicked vile temper, so I was too, and I flew out at Dutour and Rousseau."
"He was in an ugly frame of mind as well, very willing to have a fight. He could only just be civil when I made him give up the Franklin's money. God knows it was natural enough.
So you took his money away? I did not know.
Not his money. We left him his purse. His ship's money. Booty from her prizes, cash carried for stores and supplies. It is always done, you know, Stephen. You must have seen it scores of times. The chest came aboard in the forenoon watch.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Only I was not on deck at that time, and I do not believe anybody mentioned the fact. Yet I did observe a general gaiety, and Sarah stated that Dutor's nose was out of joint.
Indeed, he took it very ill. He had a great deal of money aboard. But what could he expect? We are not a philanthropic institution. Adams and I and two of the hands were telling it all the morning. There were some very curious pieces, particularly among the gold. I kept this little heap to show you.
Little do I know of money, said Stephen, but these are surely bezants. And is not this very like an archaic gold moor? Pierced and worn as a charm, no doubt.
I'm sure of it, said Jack. And what do you make of this broad piece? It is rubbed almost smooth, but if you hold it sideways to the light, you can make out a ship with a forward raking mast, very heavy shrouds, and an absurd high perched poop or aftercastle.
In time, Jack finished his dinner, and when they were drinking their coffee, Stephen said,
I made a remarkable discovery this morning. I believe it will make a great stir in the Royal Society when I read my paper, and Cuvier will be amazed.
He described the extraordinarily unyielding nature of the frigate bird's bosom, contrasting it with that of other fowl, no more rigid than an indifferent wicker basket, and spoke of its probable connection with a creature's soaring flight. As it was usual with them when they spoke of the lie of the land, naval manoeuvres or the like, he traced lines on the table with wine, and Jack, following with keen attention, said,
I take your point, and I believe you are right. For this, do you see, drawing a ship seen from above, is the mainyard when we are close-hauled on the starboard tack. It is braced up sharp with a larboard brace, here is the larboard brace, the sheet hauled aft, the weather-leach is hauled forward with bowlines twanging taut, and the tack hauled aboard, brought down to the chest-trees and well bowsed upon. When all this is done in a seaman-like manner, there is precious little give, flat as a board, and a stiff, well-trimmed ship fairly flies along. Surely there is a parallel here.
Certainly. If you will come next door, I will show you the bones in question and their coalescence, and you will judge the degree of rigidity yourself, comparing it with that of your sheets and tress trees. I was called away before the dissecting was quite complete, before everything was as white and distinct as a specimen or example mounted for an anatomy lesson, but you will never dislike a little blood and slime.
Stephen was not a heavy, impercipient man in most respects. Yet he had known Jack Aubrey all these years without discovering that he disliked even a very little blood and slime extremely, that is to say, cold blood and slime. In battle he was accustomed to wading ankle-deep in both without the least repulsion, laying about him in a very dreadful manner. But he could scarcely be brought to wring a chicken's neck, still less watch a surgical operation.
"You will take the exposed furcula between your finger and thumb," Stephen went on, "and all proportions guarded you will gauge its immobility."
Jack gave a thin smile. Seven excuses came to his mind, but he was much attached to his friend, and the excuses were improbable at the best. He walked slowly forward into what had once been his dining cabin, and was now, to judge from the reek, a charnel house. He did indeed take the exposed furcula, as he was desired to do, and he listened to Stephen's explanations with his head gravely inclined. He looked not unlike a very large dog that was conscientiously carrying out an unpleasant duty. But how happy he was when the duty was done, when the explanations came to an end, and when he could walk out into the fresh air with a clear conscience.
"Everything is laid along, sir," said Veedle, meeting him at the head of the companion ladder. "The chest is up, the Frenchman ordered below, and Mr. Adams is by the capstan with the muster book."
"Very good, Mr. Veedle," said Jack, breathing deep.
He glanced at the sky. He glanced aft, where the Franklin lay on the frigate's quarter a cable's length away, throwing a fine bow wave.
"Let us take in royals and t'gallant stunsails."
Veedle had hardly relayed the order before the topmen were racing aloft. The royals and t'gallant stunsails vanished, the ship's way sensibly decreased, and Jack said,
"All hands aft, if you please."
"Mr. Buckley, pipe all hands aft," said Veedle to the boatswain, who replied, "All hands after it, sir,"
and instantly wound his call, sharp blasts, followed by a long, quavering shriek.
This was the first official information to reach the foremast hands, but if anyone aboard was so simple as to expect them to be surprised at the news, he was wholly mistaken. They had all contrived to be clean, shaved, sober and properly dressed. They all had their hats, and now they all swarmed aft along the larboard gangway, overflowing onto the quarterdeck in the usual shapeless heap. There they stood, grinning and sometimes nudging one another, and Jack called out,
"Now, shipmates, we are going to proceed to a provisional sharing out. But this is all to be by silver, Spanish dollars, or pieces of eight, shillings and bits, or by gold that everybody knows, guineas, louis d'or, ducats, joes, and the like. The old-fashioned outlandish pieces will be sold by weight and shared accordingly. Mr. Weddle, hands out of Beckett's."
The unhappy boy blushed crimson, whipped his hands from his pockets, and crept behind the taller Norton with what countenance he could summon.
"Paper notes and bills, and, of course, hull fittings, goods, and head money, come in the final reckoning."
"If spared?" murmured Mr. Veedle.
"Just so," said Jack. "If spared. Mr. Adams, carry on."
"Ezekiel Ayrton,"
cried Mr. Adams, his finger on the open muster book. And Ayrton, for topman, starboard watch, came aft, happy though somewhat conscious of being alone and in the public gaze. He walked across the quarterdeck, taking off his hat as he came, but instead of passing straight on beyond the captain to the windward gangway and so forward, as he would have done at an ordinary muster, he advanced to the capstan. There, upon the capstan head, Adams paid down 2 guineas, 1 louis d'or, 2 ducats, 1 Venetian, the other Dutch, and enough pieces of 8 and Jamaica bits to bring the sum to £27.06.04. Ayrton swept them into his hat with a chuckle, moved on 2 paces, and touched his forehead to the captain.
"Give you joy of them, Ayrton,"
said Jack, smiling at him. So it went throughout the alphabet, with more laughter and outbursts of wit than would have been countenanced in a more regular man of war, until a minute after John Yardley, yeoman of the sheets, had joined his jocose, wealthy companions on the forecastle, when all merriment was cut to instant silence by the hail from the masthead,
"On deck there! Object fine on the starboard bow! Which I believe is a barrel!"